Okay. Good evening, everyone. I'm Asha Nayaswamy. It's March, almost the end of March, the year 2020. I say that because this video may be viewed at many different times, and history will show that in the San Francisco Bay Area and in America, we are cresting on the coronavirus pandemic. So I'm going to just give my class about the Bhagavad Gita, but that's the context in which we're living right now, and it seemed worth mentioning to you. I don't know if it'll come up in the conversation or not, but it's influencing all of us, making ageless teachings even more relevant, because we're all facing something on this planet that we've never faced before, and that we've never faced before, not that it's ever been faced in the history of man, but we're facing it. So it's bringing everybody into their spine, hopefully. All devotees are getting strong in their spine. And Master said that hard times would come to this world in order to bring people closer to God. So I guess I'm going to speak about this for a minute. So having an event like this happen where something affects every single human being on the globe, but it's not being done to us by human beings, although there's some conspiracy theories that say it is, but the actual vehicle, I'm not going to comment on them. I'm just saying people say that. But but the vehicle is not human. The vehicle is not even visible. It's not war. It's not nuclear war. It's not dictators. It's not genocide. It's this invisible item that is threatening the well-being of everyone on the planet, and no amount of emphatic ego determination in and of itself is going to actually affect it. Of course, right action, right thought, and good karma will. For those of you who are watching this either in real time or within this time sphere, most 5 mornings a week at 9 a.m., Pacific Standard Time, U.S., I'm giving a broadcast, just a 30-minute broadcast. And those are on my YouTube channel. It's called Sheltering in Place with Asha. And if you're interested, we've talked about subjects like suffering and death and karma and, you know, the big topics that we really want to talk about. So having said that now, having oriented yourself and myself, we are progressing through Swami's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. We are in chapter 15 of his commentary, which is only chapter 3 of the Gita. And the chapter 15 is called Freedom Through Action. And we are on chapter 30 of the Gita, stanza number 20. By the path of right action alone, Raja Janakananda and others like him, karma yogis, attained perfection. To offer guidance to others, you too should be active. Isn't that wonderful? You know, there's the wonderful joke about the disciple who goes into the ashram and he's introduced, he's shown around by one of the other, by his guru bhai. He talks about the schedule they have of sadhana and of work and of austerities, and this is what they have to do and that's what they have to do. And then he's shown that all the guru does is sit in the meditation hall and just meditates all day. And he doesn't have to do any of the farm work. He doesn't have to cook. He doesn't have to do any of the cleaning. He doesn't have to carry water. He doesn't have to chop wood. So the would-be disciple asks whether he can just enter the ashram as the guru, because it looks like his job is a lot easier than that of the disciples. Well, the point is that when you can do everything else the guru can do, then you can have that position. So this section of the Gita is also talking, and the next verse also, whatever the superior being does, lesser beings imitate. So even as an example to others, which is what it says here, to offer guidance to others, you too should be active. Now, of course, to offer guidance to ourselves, we too should be active. You know, it's low energy is the enemy of self-realization. In another section in this book, I'm not sure we've passed it yet, I think it comes later, Swamiji talks about the three gunas, and it's very interesting. Everything about the spiritual path is in the Bhagavad Gita, which is why it's been studied so seriously by so many saints for so long. I'm stopping for a minute. I have a friend in Russia who wrote to me, and I really don't know what to do about this. She said, I would so like to subtitle your talks, but you talk too fast. She said, I can't make Russian subtitles as fast as you talk. And I don't quite know what to do with it. When she was in my living room and she was translating, I don't know Russian. I don't know anything about Russian, but it seemed to go on a lot longer than my English did. And so I was speeding up. For the sake of everyone, I'll try to slow down for just a minute. When I'm being simultaneously translated, or sequentially translated, I do try to slow down. So I will. Give me a moment. I'll sip water. Now, somewhere in this commentary, Swami talks about the three gunas, the downward pulling energy of tamas, the activating quality of rajas, and the uplifting quality of sattva. And there's all this commentary in the Gita about how creation itself is a balancing act of all of these gunas and so on. But the guru is the one who has transcended all three gunas, meaning he's transcended the interplay of forces that makes the material world. And so that is where we're going. We're trying to transcend all the fluctuations of matter. But in order to do that, we have to liberate ourselves from the downward pulling energy. And the downward pulling energy, tamas, is what makes us lazy and what makes us inactive, and it's what makes us settle for second best. In other words, it's too much trouble to really do it well. I'll just do it badly. It's good enough. And of course, sometimes it is good enough, but sometimes we say it's good enough because we don't want to put out the rest of the energy. So I've always had this, I'm not a perfectionist because I'm quite comfortable realizing that it is good enough. For example, I'll just use as a recent example for me. During this time of year, I usually make the costumes for our school play. I did make the costumes, or I arrange the costumes. I don't do all the sewing, but I do a lot of the sewing. We didn't have a production this year because it got canceled because of the virus. But nonetheless, we brought ourselves right up to the edge of it. But what is good enough for a monkey costume for a kindergarten student who's only going to wear it a few times and then may see the light of day as a monkey costume for a kindergarten student later? What's good enough for a monkey costume is really good enough. It's just not necessary to make a fine finished garment. So it's being efficient, but it's not being tamasic. It's just realizing that sometimes when people are perfectionists, they just compulsively will make that monkey costume, you know, win a prize at the state fair, when it just really doesn't need to. The kindergarten child is going to be fine and its parents are going to be fine. So I've always had a drive for excellence, but it's not a drive for perfectionism. I'm too practical for that. But nonetheless, I've always known that it was really important to put out full energy. It's just what we're supposed to do. And reading that in the commentary, it was actually really helpful. And Swami put it in the commentary that way. We have to strive for excellence because what keeps us from excellence is tamoguna. And we have to master tamoguna in order to be able to transcend the three gunas, because tamo is the one that just wants us to shrink instead of to expand. This is why also that the saints have to set a dynamic example for us. Now, not all saints are karma yogis. Not all saints are active in the world. We, meaning those of us who follow Paramahansa Yogananda and Swami Kriyananda, our path is very active in the world at this time. When we were early years at Ananda Village, and we were just, you know, we were trying to make this community from the ground up, and we had to work really a lot. And Swami Kriyananda set the example for us. He worked really a lot, many, many hours every day, and, you know, with very few holidays, just constant. Swami was balanced, but he was enormous in his energy output, and not everybody enjoyed that. People, especially in the 70s, when a lot of people were coming out of being hippies or in the drug culture, Well, you know, especially if you smoked marijuana and things like that, which was a lot of what was going on at that time, not at Ananda, because we meditated in those days. It was even actually, you could actually get across the Canadian border without having your car searched, because if they asked you about marijuana, you said, no, I don't smoke marijuana, I meditate. They were considered to be opposites. At least that was the rumor that went around. Everything was a lot looser in those days, even if you looked like you might have marijuana in the car. If you could prove that you meditated, they would believe you, or so I was told. I never tested it. I never had to test it. But in any case, there was a lot of thinking that spirituality was just to kind of let go. Let go, let down, have fun, do nothing, go to the river. Swami Kriyananda talked about how in the early years of Ananda Village, the first couple of years, late 60s, you know, they were perfectly fine to let him work and pay the mortgage. If he was so materialistic as to be worried about the mortgage, he could work and pay it, whereas they would commune with God by hanging out at the river. So there was a little bit of tamoguna in that story. But somebody came to Swami with a book, published probably by SRF at that time, with some line in it that Master said, you know, the ideal lifestyle is, you know, you meditate several hours in the morning, and then you do a little God-reminding work, and then you have a little bit of recreation, and then you meditate several hours at night. You know, and it was like so far from the life that we were living. And Swami read it, looked at it like this, and then he sort of slammed the book shut. He said, that's for a higher age. He said, we are, he used to call it, we have to establish a beachhead, is how he put it, for Master's work. So all of it to say is that the example that was set both by Master himself, who, if you read his letters to Rajasi, who was his most advanced disciple, he was, and to Dr. Lewis, I don't know if the Rajasi letters are published, but the Dr. Lewis letters are available. He was always talking about how much he was working, how much money he had to earn, and how much he was working all the time, hours and hours, and hardly sleeping and traveling all over, because this is what was required to get this new message of self-realization firmly planted in the world. And those of us who came to help Master by helping Swami, that's what we have to do. We have to set the example for others by keeping busy, because we have to raise our energy. We have to escape from tamoguna, raise our energy into rajas. Then we can become sattvic. Because sattvic and rajas can kind of look the same. Rajas is calm, tamasic is asleep, but somebody who's very calm and somebody who's asleep might look the same, but they're entirely different. One is exceedingly high energy and full awareness, and the other is exceedingly low energy and no awareness. So you have to go all the way through to the end. So this is what the Gita is talking about here, which is, and you can attain perfection that way. Swami actually, well, he talked about attunement, which is not quite the same as service. But Swami also writes in, it's in the Patanjali commentary, he says, the most effective, the fastest, or the best, I'm not sure which one of those words he uses, it's a very straightforward statement, the best way to overcome the ego is selfless service. There's a pretty strong statement, serving others, not just sitting there and meditating, but even if you're meditating, have your meditation be a service to others. Not merely meditating for my own advancement, but meditating as a service to others. And if we get to stanza 21 today, I'm not sure we will, but if we do, we begin to talk a lot about that. But now I wanted to just read a paragraph here, because there's some ideas in here that are so interesting. Let's see how we... he said, Lahiri Mahashaya often quoted another great rishi's teachings, which is this phrase, if you want to achieve freedom from reincarnation, the rishi says, abhor sense pleasures as you would sugar-coated poison. I'm going to just let that one go for a moment because it's the second part that interests me. And be as devotedly attached to acts of forgiveness, pity, contentment, and love of truth and God as to drinking nectar. So I was really intrigued by forgiveness, pity, which means compassion. Compassion's a nicer word than pity. They're slightly different, but nonetheless. Forgiveness, pity, contentment, and love of truth and God. So if we're going to talk about what right action is and where true salvation, true happiness, and very interestingly, the very next stanza, which I said we may get to this week or not, is all about how to serve the world and how essential it is. Let's see. How essential it is to realize that the only way the society will be transformed is if individual consciousness is transformed. And I can actually see that they sort of go together, what we're talking about. Because, you know, all these efforts by people to make the world the way I want it to be tends to just run into somebody else wanting to make the world exactly the way they want it to be. At this particular time in American history, our country is uniquely, perhaps not uniquely, but notably, just rigidly divided. And people are becoming ever more intense in their absolute commitment to one political system or another political system. And each side believes that their way is going to make it better. But there's no evidence in any historical record that any political system ever really made it better. The way that society has been transformed has always been by a spiritual revolution, an expansion of consciousness that takes us into a greater understanding of our relationship to a greater reality. And in that greater reality, our relationship to our brothers and sisters who share the planet with us, and all creatures who share the planet with us. And what's been happening in the disintegration of our society is this: we've just become lost in our sense of a higher reality. Now, part of that is that there has been a disintegration of form. And this is the transition from Kali Yuga into Dwapara Yuga. Kali Yuga is the age of matter. And in the age of matter, matter is fixed. You know, this is the book, this is my leg, this is the chair, this is my teacup. You know, it's just like everything is solid. It appears to be solid. So if you're a Methodist, you can't be a Hindu. If you're a Hindu, you can't be a Buddhist. If you're a Buddhist, you know, you can't be a Jew. Because Jews are Jews, and Hindus are Hindus, and Christians are Christians. And even among Christianity, if you're a Methodist, you can't be a Lutheran. If you're a Lutheran, you can't be a Catholic. If you're a Catholic, you can't be a Christian Scientist. And just so you have all these little categories, and every person stands firmly in what they are. That's what Kali Yuga is, because it's a material age. And we think that a teacup is a teacup and a book is a book. Well, now in the last few centuries, beginning in 1700, turning strongly in 1900, Sri Yukteswar tells us, we're moving into an age of energy. And so science has begun to figure out that although the teacup looks separate from the book, it's just our perception of it. Because if we could see it as it really is, we would realize that it's all just vibrations of energy, vibrating at different patterns. I have an absolute zero capacity to understand when the scientists explain to me. When someone is actually explaining to me, I understand it, but I can never repeat it. But you can read many other very good books. The Physics of God, for example, written by my friend Joseph Selby. When I read it, I understand it, and explains to us the physics of God, about how everything is energy and ultimately consciousness and so on. But for the purpose of this discussion, you see, as we're moving into Dwapara Yuga, we are all beginning to think in terms of energy. And so the rigidity of forms is actually just being undermined by this rising consciousness that a form is a very thin layer laid over this energy universe. And whereas the form is just, you know, a 16th of an inch deep, it's the energy behind it. And what's also happening to us is that we ourselves as human beings are much more concerned about the energy of things than we are about the form. The way this is expressed in spirituality is it's gone in lots of interesting directions. One of them is that people will say that they're not religious, but they're spiritual, that they don't have a label for what they are. They don't have a denomination that they belong to or a tradition that they claim. In fact, there's a repudiation of all those forms and a feeling of I'm spiritual because of who I am, not because of the label that I put on myself. And so this has resulted in my Protestant clergy friends have talked to me about this, in what they call a loss of denominational loyalty. You know, 25, 50 years ago, even when I was a child, if you came to town, you would look for the Lutheran church if you were a Lutheran, or the Methodist church if you were a Methodist, or whatever, the Catholic church if you were a Catholic. Now, often, if people look for a church at all, they'll look for the one that inspires them. And they'll go and they'll look for the energy. And if the energy is good, they don't care what the form is, or they don't care as they used to care what the form is. They just like the energy in that place. They like the inspiration in this place. So all that is to the good. But as we go through this transition, people are very confused. When I was a child, for one thing, stores were not even open on Sunday. But it was unthinkable that there would be events for children on Sunday morning. Just absolutely unthinkable, because the family would go to church. I was Jewish, so we had our Saturday, and it was a little confusing, but nonetheless, you know, on Sundays, just nothing happened in the morning for children. Now, children's soccer matches are in the morning, and people don't even think it's strange. My favorite awful story, I like to exercise by swimming until, of course, the gym closed down recently. And the best place for me around here is the YMCA, which many people don't even know means Young Men's Christian Association. It was started, now it's just voted the best gym in Palo Alto, but it was started as a religious organization. It morphed, and part of the religious mission was physical vitality, but it's just morphed into a health club. And on Easter Sunday, they kept limited hours, and those limited hours were from 9 to 1, which is exactly the time people go to church on Easter morning. It was just like, I mean, I was the only one even who noticed. Oh, how convenient. You know, we can go swimming. We can go work out on Sunday morning. The fact that it's Easter, it's like no one even noticed. Okay, now, where am I going with all of this? Where I'm going with all of this is it's the best of times and it's the worst of times. It's the best of times because people are having to think for themselves. We can't just sort of, you know, sign up for the Methodist Church, sign up for the Catholic Church, and be sure of going to heaven. Garrison Keillor is the author of a remark that I really love. He said, "To think you can become a Christian by sitting in church is like sitting in your garage expecting to become a car." Which is just so ludicrous. But I just absolutely loved it. Every time I think of that, it's just not automatic. Just coming into the room is not going to change you. You know, even just following the dictums is not going to change you. What's going to change you is who you actually are. God reads the heart, is what Swami said to me once in a very critical moment in my life when I just couldn't figure out how I could tell whether I was doing the right thing, because so often, and in that particular instance, I had tried so hard to do the right thing, and it had turned out to be very much the wrong thing. And I just didn't know how to think about it. But he said, God reads the heart. And what he meant by that was it's the vibration of our consciousness. And the vibration of our consciousness is the purity of our heart, the purity of our intention. My judgment was really poor, but I was really trying to be helpful. I just had very poor judgment in the context. But I had a pure intention. I mean, and sometimes we just can't make things go right in the world. We forces either we misread a situation too badly, our own karma is such that success is not in the cards for us, or we get caught up in group karma that just makes our individual karma unable to manifest in the world, but that doesn't change the purity of our intention. And even in the Christian Bible, Jesus says in the Beatitudes, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." And in the Beatitudes, he says, "Blessed those who forgive, they will be forgiven. You know, those who mourn will be comforted." So what you do comes back to you, but purity of heart gives you God realization, which is really quite something when you think about it. So once we move outside of religious dogma and the idea that if I just do these certain things, then these certain things are guaranteed to happen because these are the rules, and if I follow them, you know, but they're, the rules are purity of heart. And Jesus himself said that. He said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The discipline that we follow is in order to follow this Rishi's advice, to learn to repudiate self-interest and embrace divine interest. And so there are definitely practices that will help transform us internally. But it's not the practice that is the point. It's the purification that results from the practice that is the point. You know, and see, this all gets very subtle as we go with it. And Jesus, all that time ago, tried to correct it, because at the time that he incarnated as the avatar to the Jewish people, the corrupt priesthood, and that's a better way to put it than to say the Jews, because Jesus was a Jew, everybody was a Jew, and the problem was there were enlightened people operating within the Jewish construct, and there were unenlightened people operating within the Jewish construct, and that's just the way it always is. There was a corrupt priesthood that had become so oriented toward rules and had developed so much power to enforce those rules that the intention of those rules was lost. And what prompted Jesus to say what he did was that he healed someone on the Sabbath. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And he healed someone on the Sabbath. And so this corrupt priesthood accused him of blasphemy, of ignoring the dictates of God. And Jesus' answer first was, if your sheep falls into the ditch on the Sabbath, you're going to pull him out. You're not going to leave him there to die. You can't leave him there to die. And he said, you know, the Sabbath was made to help man. Man is not here to serve the Sabbath. I'm going to just digress for a little bit just because this was interesting to me. Some of you know I spent the month of January in Jerusalem, but actually Israel, much of it in Jerusalem. And I learned a lot about the Sabbath, which even though I grew up Jewish, I didn't really understand it because we were Reform, we weren't Orthodox. But the whole country of Israel shuts down from Friday night to Saturday night, from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. In the Jewish system, the day begins at sunset. So the Sabbath is the Saturday, but it begins when the sun goes down on Friday, and it ends when the sun goes down on Saturday, that 24-hour period. And now there's all these rules related to it about what you can and can't do. For example, in the hotels where we would stay, you can't cook, you can't use electrical devices, you can't turn on your phones, you can't take emails, you just can't use any machines. The family does all the cooking before the Sabbath starts and then just enjoys what they've done. And let me just try to get this straight. In the hotel where we were staying in Jerusalem, a lot of people would come to Jerusalem for the Sabbath, and they would let the hotel do all the work, and they would just, and it was actually very sweet. The hotel would fill up with families and children, and they would all be very, very merry for the 24 hours. But because it was in a 14-story hotel, there were elevators. But on the Sabbath, if you were an Orthodox Jew, you couldn't push the button because that was considered, well, the way they talked about that was considered to be work. You couldn't push the button. So there was the Sabbath elevator, and the Sabbath elevator would just stop at every floor. And you never had to push the button. And if you didn't want to stop at every floor, you had to get in the other one. You know, you sort of can start arguing it. There's no point in arguing it. But somebody gave me a booklet that was a much more enlightened view of what the Sabbath is, and I absolutely loved it. I loved the concept of the Sabbath anyway, to actually stop work and pay attention to your family, to your personal inner life, and so on. Master recommended one day of seclusion a week. It's exactly the same. That's the Sabbath, one day of seclusion. Because here's the principle behind it. We spend all our time trying to bring about a certain result in the material world. Now, we call that work, but we're trying to influence the world. We're trying to get our kids to school on time. We're trying to get to work on time. We're trying to, you know, make enough money. We're trying to invent something. We're just trying to make something happen and influence what happens around us. On the Sabbath, we are supposed to simply accept whatever is around us. And it's put like we don't work. We don't push the button. We don't turn on the light. We don't turn on the computer. We don't try to communicate. We just stop. And we just accept. One woman talking to me who observed the Sabbath talked about how they, before the sun goes down on Friday night, they turn on whatever electric lights they want in their house because they're not going to be able to turn them on again. And she said, if we forget, and I didn't understand this till now, she said, I just accept that God wants me to sit in the dark. But you see, that would be what it was. I'm no longer going to try to influence what happens. I'm just going to say, let what comes of itself, let it come. Isn't that a beautiful and interesting thought? And that's not so distant from what Master says about seclusion. It's just not so rule-bound. It's just, I will withdraw, and I will sit within my inner consciousness and experience my inner consciousness without trying to make the outer world conform to my will. And that, according to what I read in this lovely book, is what the real intention of the Sabbath is. And I could feel it when I was in Israel. I could feel that this is a wonderful practice. And I have to say, being of Jewish origin and being there, I knew what it meant. I know what it means to the Jewish people to be able to have a country where everybody stops for the Sabbath. Because all of us have grown up in worlds where the Christian Sabbath is Sunday and the Jewish Sabbath is Saturday. But when the whole country just stops. Well, it's not true because the whole Arab world there doesn't. But the formality of the country, the majority of the country stops. Now, what that's all about, truly, is changing inner consciousness, whether or not, oh, I know what I was going to say. But so you would feel in Israel, you would feel this magnificent pause. Even though, as I was saying, the Arab world would keep moving, the Palestinian world would keep moving. And in fact, even for us, on the Sabbath days, everybody goes to Bethlehem, which is in the Palestinian territory. And so Bethlehem is really crowded on Saturday. We found this out. During the week, it's not so crowded, but everybody leaves the Israeli side and goes to the Palestinian side on the Sabbath because Israel's closed. But the feeling of everything stopping was so uplifting. And I thought, it's not time yet for Ananda to be able to do that. And even when we've tried, it hasn't yet succeeded. When I lived at the seclusion, what was the seclusion retreat, which was the meditation retreat in the early 70s, where about 30 or 40 community members also had their homes there. It was a guest facility, but it was also we had the other location for the community, but a lot of community members lived at the meditation retreat. I ran the kitchen, and I cooked for those people. I was that kitchen was the source of almost everyone's food because we didn't have houses that had their own kitchens. We just had sleeping quarters somewhere, a trailer, a tiny cabin. And Now let me think what I was going to say. Oh, yes. And every Thursday was a fast day for everybody, for the guests and everyone, in theory. This is what I'm going to say. I often had to go to town and get groceries on that day. It wasn't the Sabbath, just I didn't have to cook. But, you know, one by one, all the community members would figure out where the key to the kitchen was. And they would all just sneak in and get their own food, you know, over the course of that day. It was just like, we just couldn't stop. We couldn't really stop. The theory was that we would stop, but we just couldn't stop. So some people would fast, but almost everyone would find a way to eat. It got even worse when we tried to cut coffee out. We're a yoga retreat, we won't serve coffee, that's what we said. So all the poor guests would be in the dining room wishing they could have coffee, and all the residents would be in the kitchen having coffee. And then gradually the guests would figure out where everybody was, and then everybody would be in the kitchen having coffee, which became so completely silly that we just took it back out into the dining room. Now, what all that is about is, let me just think where I was trying to go with all of that. Oh, which it's just not time yet. We have too much work to do. It's not, that's where I was going to say. I was going back to Swami saying, it's not just not time yet, but it will be. And insofar as we're able, really, it's a God-given habit that Master endorsed, one day of seclusion a week. So now I'm finally going to come to these four points of consciousness that Lahiri was advocating. The first is, as devotedly attached to acts of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a very, very interesting word. The next paragraph Swami talks about, he says, all of these things, forgiveness, pity, contentment, and love of truth in God, Swami says, must be practiced impersonally, without referring anything back to your own ego. And he says, in forgiveness, for example, never think, I am the one forgiving, for in that thought, pride can enter the mind. I've always had a little problem with that word forgiveness, because it always has implied to me exactly what Swami's saying. You made a mistake, but I'm so noble, I will forgive you. And it's never felt to me it's always felt to me a little bit fraught with danger. And I always love it when Swami articulates for me something that I can feel but I'm not quite comfortable with. Now, of course, forgiveness is a fabulous word, but I find a better way of thinking about it, which makes me feel safer, is that I just simply accept what is. Because, see, what forgiveness is, I was blaming you. I was holding you responsible. I was judging you. I was suffering because of you. But now I forgive you. But there's an awful lot of I's in that one. I am the victim, but now I'm going to let it go. But instead, you just say, that's what happened. Somebody was speaking to me not too long ago about having felt betrayed by someone, which was valid. And I asked sort of why and how and what. And basically what happened was the person had failed to live up to their own ideals. The other person had failed to live up to their own ideals. The person who felt betrayed had believed the betrayer's affirmation that they were going to behave better. But then that person couldn't live up to it. And as a consequence, my friend was hurt and felt betrayed. But I said, she didn't betray you. She betrayed herself. She had set her ideals and she couldn't live up to them. That really actually had nothing to do with you. You were impacted by it. But what is there to forgive? And this is where pity, which I will call compassion, really compassion is really what we should have. Oh my, somebody did something that was really not the best thing for them to have done. And what I need to feel for them is compassion. And compassion, it does lead to forgiveness, because it leads to the realization in the most impersonal way that this actually has nothing to do with me. This person has simply just done, they've lived their life. The way it occurred to me recently when I got all involved in this situation and someone was writing to me about forgiveness, asking for forgiveness, my response was, I don't really have anything for you to forgive. It's true that things that you did caused great inconvenience for me. There was great inconvenience. There appears to have been a cause and effect relationship. Master said something that was very interesting once. He said, because we believe in time, and because we live in the realm of time, in which one event seems to follow after another, we get the mistaken impression that one event causes another. Now, there's a lot of interesting words in there. We're living in time. Events seem to happen in sequence. And so because this happens and then that happens, we tend to think that this caused that. I'll give you another example of how you can think about that. There was a couple that I knew who were married for a very brief period of time. It was not a terrifically good idea. It wasn't a really good match from the beginning, but it was their karma to experience it. And the reason it wasn't a good match is because both of them had an enormous amount of unresolved issues that caused them to feel unhappy a great deal of the time. Oh, I know what I want to say. But neither of them was actually aware of where their unhappiness was coming from. You know, to live successfully in a relationship with another person requires, let me say, it's helped greatly by understanding the degree of self-understanding that each person in the partnership has greatly enhances the harmony of the partnership. Because if you understand yourself, then you know where your unhappiness is coming from. If you don't understand yourself and you have a tremendous amount of unresolved inner issues, be it childhood, past lives, who cares what it's from, he says something to her, she suddenly feels emotional pain, it happens sequentially after he spoke, therefore he caused it. She says something to him, he feels emotional pain, it happens sequentially after she spoke, he thinks she caused it. He doesn't know that this reminds him of the way his mother treated him. He doesn't know that what she said falls right into this chasm of self-doubt that he carries. He just thinks she caused it. So, you know, it's just like this all the time. Because they think the other is causing the suffering. So in the context of what I was dealing with, I said simply, you participated in my karma, but you did not cause my karma. It never would have happened if I hadn't already set in motion a vast series of things that necessitated that I suffer in this certain way. So God found you to cause me pain, to do something that I would interpret as pain. But you didn't do it. You just participated in it. And insofar as you yourself may have violated your own principles, that's your issue, but it's not about me. And that's true in all of these forgiveness issues. It's just compassion for the human condition. And we need to be devoutly dedicated to that. And you see, that's extremely related also to the fourth one here, which is to the love of truth and the love of divine truth, high truth, not just mere facts, but deeply devoted to the love of truth. If we're deeply devoted to the love of truth, then forgiveness and compassion comes right along with it. Because to blame, to hold on to blame, to hold others responsible for our suffering, this is not the truth of God. You know, this is not so. We're all just here in this world. And people can behave badly. And we may observe that people behaved badly. And here it gets a little tricky. There was a friend of mine who was treated very badly by somebody she trusted. And she was striving very hard to find a way to not be hurt and not be angry. So what she tried was, well, everything was perfect. You know, everybody, it was perfect. The way things happened were just perfect. So she came to Swamiji with this. You see, all true teaching is individual. It's very important to realize this. So she comes to Swami with this, you know, there's no reason for me to be upset because everything that happened was just perfect. And Swami said, no, actually, that person behaved very badly. They shouldn't have done it. That was a very bad thing that that person did. And then he said to her, he said, you can't comfort yourself with a lie. Wow. Now, she was trying to be not judgmental. Now, judgmental is to say, I'm angry at you and you're a terrible person because you did this to me. That's judgment. And that does not help you. But to discriminate and say, well, that was an unfortunate choice on your part. You know, that really was not, you did not live up to your own highest potential when you did that. You allowed yourself to become attached, for example, to sense pleasures, which is to say, to comfort in this world, rather than holding firm to your ideals. But what we then need to feel is compassion, because especially nothing, whether we're good or evil or high-minded or low-minded, eventually, every time we violate divine law, we're going to suffer. And who wants to suffer? None of us want to suffer. But we also have to learn what causes suffering, which is not always so obvious. And we also have to balance our karmic debts, which is why things happen to us that may not seem fair. Now, I have to say, this is a really scary teaching. It really is a scary teaching because there's no victims and there's no perpetrators. But God knows there's an awful lot of evil in this world. And a lot of seemingly innocent people are victimized, or I should say taken advantage of, or a lot of really awful things happen. So this part of it where you have to actually have a great love for truth and for God, well, the spiritual path is not easy. And God sends us extraordinarily difficult challenges to test our capacity to discriminate, to discern evil when evil is present, to perceive someone who has become a vehicle for that evil, to have enormous compassion for those whose lives are impacted by that evil, and yet still understand that we are all part of a greater reality, and that whatever comes to us would not come to us unless in the end it's going to draw us closer to God. You know, we're, as I said at the beginning, this is March 2020, and we're at the beginning or in the middle of this pandemic, which is not only having and may have more, we just don't know, catastrophic consequences on human health and human life, and may also have, you know, ever rippling down effects on economies and securities. I mean, we just have no idea where this is going. And Master said that there would be terrible earth changes that would cause a great deal of suffering for a lot of people. There are conspiracy theories circulating at this point saying that this is a man-made catastrophe for all kinds of nefarious reasons. I'm not even going to comment on that. When someone brought those theories to me, I said, well, anything is possible, but what difference would it make? Whether Divine Mother is using a virus or using an evil cartel of mighty, powerful, but evil people to bring a karmic reckoning to the planet and a karmic reckoning to us, our response still has to be the same. Forgiveness, compassion, contentment, and this means accepting that which must be accepted. And that is, it's very important to understand, contentment is not passive. You know, contentment is one of the cardinal virtues, but contentment is not passive. The way Swamiji expressed it, which is a very important way to express it, even if you want to influence it, you have to accept what the conditions are. You can't just wish those conditions away. And you have to be content, and this may sound paradoxical, but it isn't. You have to be content with the fact that this is what I have to work with. And so even if my response is an extreme dynamic effort to create a new reality, I'm not in rebellion against the necessity to do it. I was faced with a difficult test a number of years ago in my life, and it was very interesting to me. I was really mad at God. I was really mad at the gurus. It took me a while to really realize how mad I was at the gurus. Finally, I saw that what was an unidentified wave of feeling in me, I was really mad at God. And the reason I was mad at God is not because he'd put me at that time, what seemed to me at that time, into a very difficult situation, but because I knew I was going to have to raise my energy to meet it. And it wasn't even that I doubted that I could do it, or that I felt that him challenging me in this way was unfair, that anything that happened to me wasn't deserved. All of it was fine, but I knew it was going to take so much energy to be able to face it that I was just so mad at him for just forcing me to have to work so hard. Of course, it helped after a while when I realized that that was really what the issue was. So I was content. I was content with the fact that I was going to have to put out energy like I'd never had to put out energy before. So I wasn't passive, you see, because what I loved is truth. What I do love is truth, and what I do love is God. And if you love God, and if you trust that he loves you, and that's what you always have to challenge. So how could this that's happening to me, how could this that's happening to the world, how could this that might happen to people I love, how could, you know, my security be taken away? How could my health, my life, my loved ones, my home, you know, we're living in very interesting times. Most of the time, until like 2 or 3 weeks ago, this was like a someday. And you could see all these forces on the planet. You just sort of wondered where it was going to pop, you know, where it was going to really come apart. Now, yes, vast swaths of this planet are terribly disrupted, and refugee camps and wars and so on. But the world that I've been living in has not been interrupted until now. And this, again, may roll the whole world out. So how much do I love God? And how much do I trust God's love for me? This is why this is just like these 4 points are just so interesting. And it's so often you can just take the path and just simplify it. And just take that simple one and just keep burrowing deeper and deeper into that simple one. This is why that's another way to study the Gita. When Master was with Sri Yukteswar studying the Gita, they would just read one verse and then meditate on it. And meditate on it for a long time. And Master sometimes felt, he said, impatient. Why don't we go on to the next verse? And Sri Yukteswar said, because we haven't penetrated deeply enough into the meaning of this verse. And then actually subsequently said to Master at a certain point, you don't need to study anymore because you've gotten the essence of what all of this teaching is, and then you'll be able to look at any verse or any scripture and you'll be able to go to the heart of it. And so this is what we do with little sentences like this. You know, forgiveness, which is to realize that, to accept that this is what reality is. Nobody's a victim, nobody's a perpetrator. We're all just living through our karma trying to get to God. And that doesn't mean, as I was saying a minute ago, that your action was honorable. And you might have to say sometimes that people are actually instruments of evil, because it does happen. But I am an instrument of light, and God will not send me something unless in the end it's for my liberation. So what am I supposed to learn? I need to be content that this is the lesson that God has really given to me, and then my passion for truth and my faith in Him will then bring me to the next step. You know, this is a time when we all really get to learn a lot. And this is the time when we need to use this time. I know a lot of people whose pattern of life has been severely interrupted. Since I skew toward being introverted, oddly enough, despite the fact that I talk all the time, left to my own devices, I have a different personality. And also being a devotee, I'm accustomed to solitude and I like solitude. But many people are not at all. And even those of us who are devotees suddenly have this vast open space in front of us. Will we use it to draw closer to God? Or will we just waste this time and gain nothing from it? Will we use the fear that is threatening us to strengthen our spine and have more courage and practice our faith in every small way that we can, so that if this does in fact escalate, we'll be building our capability of acceptance? You know, oftentimes the big success is based on the little success. And the big transcendence is based on the little transcendence. A woman came to me once and she was terribly afflicted by this tremendous anger she felt toward her mother. And objectively, she had a lot of reasons. She had not been gifted with the best mother that there ever was. But the anger she carried for her mother was just too big. So I said, well, you know, oftentimes the big fault that we have is also a little fault. I said, do you have a tendency to be angry at other times? Oh, no, she said, you know, like this. But I knew her. And I knew she often reacted with anger. Who didn't wash the dishes? Why is that man driving so slowly? I wanted that last carton of milk, and now it's gone from the store. And when we discussed it, she began to see that. I said, you're not going to be able to dismantle your feeling towards your mother. But I said, but you can react differently to every small time that same impulse comes to you, and you will find you can break the habit. And when you break the habit, then you'll eventually be able to undo the big one. So here we are now, and the habits we have to break, the new habits we have to acquire, I am part of a greater reality. I'm a child of Divine Mother, and my mother loves me. I need to believe that whatever comes to me and whatever challenge is mine is an appropriate challenge, and God will give me the strength to face it. You know, these are marvelous times, and if we behave properly in this incarnation, or if we're taken to the astral world from the astral world, we'll be able to say, this life was victorious. An easy life is not a victorious life. We may have to say my life was not easy, but it was victorious. That's the real meaning of Jai Guru, victory to the Guru, victory to the power of light within me. God bless you.